1987. Please come to order. Let the record show that Representative Hudson, Representative Springer, and Chairman Cato are in attendance. We have with us today members of the Yukon delegation that we're very, very happy to welcome. I personally have been on this exchange three times, and if we have another one next year, you better believe my name's going to be first on the list. Mm-hmm. Right, Randy?
Yes, ma'am.
We have with us, for the edification of Representative Hudson, Representative Springer, Tony Pendicott, who is the government leader. Tony, we kind of signal where you are. And we have Piers McDonald, who is the Minister of Transport and Community and Transportation Services, and also the Minister of Education, right?
Sure.
We have Norma Cassie, who is a member of the Legislative Assembly, Danny Joe, who's a member of the Legislative Assembly, Dan Lang, who is the Opposition House Leader, B. Firth, is a member of the Legislative Assembly, and Doug Phillips, who is a member of the Legislative Assembly. One thing that I've noticed that we don't have, that you do, and that is that the members of the leading party or the in-government party, their members are also the same status and jobs that our commissioners have. This we don't have here. We have commissioners, like Commissioner of Transportation, Commissioner of Education, and that sort of thing. So those of you that are in the leadership kind of do double duty, don't you? Does your pay change?
That does double duty, too.
That does double duty, too.
One-third duty, yes.
Yeah. So anyway, right now I'd like to have Pierce talk to us a little bit on transportation in the Yukon.
Thank you, Betty. I'd like to thank the Trust Committee on Transportation for inviting all of us to talk to you this afternoon. I think there are some dramatic developments that have been taking place over the last few years in the area of transportation in the Yukon. We certainly have increased expenditures, both maintenance and operation, as you would call it here. We reversed that to O&M. Operation and maintenance in Yukon, as part of the Yukonese lingo, I guess. And we've certainly increased the capital side of our program. We have, of course, expended significant funds over the last many years on the development of our highway system. And we will be, in shortly, I would suspect, this year, branching into the management of airports, which are currently a federal responsibility. As I'm sure state legislators are aware, we have sought access to Tidewater through the Port of Skagway in the last couple of years, successfully through negotiations with the real estate, and have committed to the upgrading of the highway between the Fraser Border Crossing and the city of Whitehorse, town of Carcross, village of Carcross. That's a fairly significant expenditure for a government of our size, though it's done with exclusively with federal funding. And it's done, I guess, to support or complement the economic development initiatives that the government has taken in the last little while. That being primarily the reopening of the Kura mine at Farrell and the need to transport ore from the Farrell mine to Tidewater in an economically justifiable fashion. As members will remember, the railway, the White Pass Railway, was the traditional ore carrier, general freight hauler, into the territory. But it was termed through the evidence that its operation was no more economically justifiable given the character of the new Kura mine, the new operation of Farrell. So the expenditures that we do make in the area of highway upgrading and highway maintenance are done primarily to support the various economic initiatives that we have. And it's not simply general freight, but it's also the enhancement of tourist activity into the Yukon and through to Alaska, ultimately, in many instances. So what was traditionally an east-west corridor, that being the Alaska highway through the Yukon, has been now expanded to include a north-south corridor from Skagway and ultimately through to the border crossing north of Dawson on the Tok in Fairbanks. So the project that we have currently underway, of course, on the highway side, the major project, the significant one, is the Skagway Road, Skagway Carcross Road. We will be enhancing that and have started to do the engineering work to enhance that to include the Top of the World Highway, which meets up with your Taylor Highway in the northern part of the state. As I say, we are, of course, interested in the state's position on the Shackler project. Maybe we might discuss that briefly later on with respect to the future development of the Haines through to Beaver Creek Yukon corridor. But we're not solely concerned, of course, with the highway transportation system. We're very interested in the marine hull, and perhaps we can talk about that later.
Yeah, I have a specialist on that.
Okay. What we're attempting to do is essentially to make sure, largely because we have so few entry points and exit points into the Yukon, we have to make sure that the corridors that we do develop have the capability to become quite open through competition. Certainly, highways lends itself to competition, and in order for there not to be any choke points in entry points into Yukon, we're quite interested in marine transportation and ensuring a competitive environment is there as well. As I mentioned briefly initially, we are going to be assuming control of what we call Arctic B&C airports in the next year, and they are everything short of the jet airports in Yukon. Though Dawson City is slated to have a jet airport and would be considered to be a B airport, Dawson City is slated to have a jet airport next year, I would hope, or construction will start next year. I guess the item that would be of most interest to you, and perhaps the one with which you'd be most familiar, would be our relationship with Skagway and the port facilities there. We are interested in seeing what we can do to encourage a more competitive environment at Port of Skagway. Currently, as you know, White Pass Yukon has the only port facilities that can handle general freight. And as I'm assured by White Pass that they can do a credible job in a non-competitive environment, we are not convinced that would be the case, and are looking to seek what alternatives we might be able to promote in the future. So we have, along with the community of Skagway, have engaged in what we call a pre-feasibility analysis of the port facilities there. The railway, for its part, has not received the final death knell by any means. There are, as you may know, there is a fellow by the name of Don Creamy who is interested in, from New York, who is interested in perhaps establishing a tourist train operation. It wouldn't be for general passenger or freight traffic, but it would be primarily, essentially, a tourist attraction. Perhaps if I'm just sort of touching on a number of major areas, I can tell you too that Canada, like the United States, is engaged in general discussions on deregulation, primarily the trucking industry and the airline industry, and certainly closer to the latter than we are to the former. And certainly Yukon is now assessing, at least the trucking industry, in association with the Department of Community and Transportation Services, is assessing the impact of deregulation attendant safety codes, etc., which would come along with it, in determining how active our participation will be. It's probably the most significant initiative on the transportation side that our country is facing currently, and we're very much part of that. Those, I would guess, are the probably the major subject areas. And if you wanted to, I could answer questions on the specifics.
Yes, Piers, I have a question I'd like to ask you. I'd like all of you to note that Representative Boucher's joined us. In the packet that we prepared, we have for each of you same packet that we have. And what we attempted to do here was to put some items of transportation issues to come before this committee. The bills, the action taken on them, various things like that. So you could kind of get yourselves familiar with the way we do things here. Piers, at noon, you made a remark to me, and you touched on it just a little bit, when you said that you wanted to see a competitive situation in the marine trade. In your packet is a copy of HJR 6, which asks Ottawa for, and I always screw up on this word, reciprocity on the Canadian Shipping Act, such as we allow, our federal government allows waivers under the Jones Act. And we did put that in your packets, and you indicated to me at noon that you also have taken this under advisement, to some extent.
Yes, as you will recall, of course, the Alaska Marine Lines have received waivers to run between the Canadian port and Skagway with goods destined for Yukon. And they had received a one-year waiver, only to have it denied last year because White Pass had indicated an interest in getting back into the shipping business with a slightly different kind of operation. Not a barge service, but a container ship service. And we, at that time, took the position as a government that we wanted to ensure that there was a competitive environment on that route. As I said at the beginning, we are probably preoccupied with the whole subject area of choke points into our territory. And we feel particularly vulnerable to that kind of, to any activity which would essentially close off one entrance to our community. So we took the position that one hauler of freight wouldn't be acceptable to us. That it would be preferable to have at least two, perhaps more, for the competitive spirit, to enhance that competitive spirit. It appears that the Canadian Transport Commission, who are the regulatory authority which offer waivers to foreign vessels, that they have essentially bought the argument put forward by White Pass, that White Pass would agree to match freight rates that had been historically provided by Alaska Marine Lines. And in the interest of protecting Canadian jobs primarily at the port in Vancouver, a laudable objective, I guess, in the national interest, the Passport Commission determined that another waiver of the permit for Alaska Marine Lines was not considered appropriate. Now, I think the situation in Canada would be somewhat different if, from our perspective, if there were a number of marine haulers from Canadian ports to Skagway. That simply isn't the case. There's also the issue that we have to tackle, and that's the issue of essentially fairness to Alaska to our neighbors. And that was certainly taken into consideration in the deliberations that we made internally as to the position that we would take. But certainly, as a general proposition, it would be our position that it would be preferable to have a number of marine haulers providing a particular service, whatever is economically justifiable, rather than simply one, essentially. Fairly simple.
I kind of think we like your position. Representative Boucher's Canadian delegation, you met this morning. Representative Hudson, would you like to talk a little bit on Marine Highway and make some comments, too?
I'd like to maybe just back up again, Pierce, on the reciprocity issue there. Have you notified the Canadian government of that position?
Yeah, we had, they had a formal hearing, and we and then deadlines to receive submissions, and we sent our submission in prior to the deadline, of course. And it was made fairly clear. The federal minister responded to me in writing, stating that in the national interests, given the kind of reassurances that White Pass had given the Transport Commission, that they would be competitive in essentially a non-competitive environment. What exists now is a non-competitive environment. That they would not be providing a waiver to the last person.
So if you were a gambling Yukon man, where is it going to go? Do you think this is the end of it, or?
Well, it's never, I guess in our system, there's never an end. You keep going back and back and back until you get your way or until you feel frustrated and give up. I think we feel it's important enough as a general issue for us that we would like ultimately in the long term to see a system which would meet our own internal best interests. And that would include perhaps dual port facilities or a number of port, some options at the port of Skagway, plus a competitive environment on the seas. And ultimately, we will continue to be making that representation to the federal government, how they approach it, or what other carriers deem necessary to do if they want to get into the business, will all affect the ultimate decision.
As Chairman Cato has asked that I speak just briefly on the Alaska State Ferry System, the Alaska Marine Highway System. I stopped this morning, as a matter of fact, to get an update briefing as to what was being projected there. Are you familiar with the system somewhat at the present time? As the vessels there now, things like that.
Greg knows the festival.
Good, yeah. Well, this is a system that has two components. It has a southwestern, I'll come and start with the easiest first, that operates basically from Seward out to Kodiak and then on westward to the points out in the Aleutian chain, all the way out to in Alaska, Dutch Harbor in that area, and then back, and that's on a very infrequent basis. Primarily that one provides service between Kodiak and the mainland in Homer or over to Seward. And then another element of that southwestern is a smaller vessel that operates basically within Prince William Sound between Valdez and Cordova and Whittier. And that's the Bartlett operates in there. Those two vessels provide the southwest link. In the southeast, there are seven ships, of which six have any consequence. The seventh one is the very small Chilcat, which really hasn't even operated now for the last year or so. It was the original vessel of all. It originally plied Prince William Sound and then was stuck in service between Juneau and Skagway, Haines and Skagway. It was the only ship for some period of time. The balance of the vessels are averaging age from about 1962, I believe it is, 63 in that neighborhood. And there are seven of them. The flagship is the motor vessel Columbia, which carries 1,000 people, roughly speaking, and about 200 vehicle units. All of our vessels, of course, as you know, carry freight. Vans carry all the way up to the largest van that is permissible over the road, including heavy road equipment and things like that. It is our highway, basically speaking, for southeast Alaska. So the southeastern Alaska system operates from Seattle all the way up to Skagway with everything in between, and has feeder vessels that go all the way out to some of the smaller villages, like Tenneke Inlet and Pelican, Cake, and a lot of the smaller villages in southeastern Alaska. It's my understanding from conversations this morning that throughout this summer, we'll see basically the same level of service that we've had in this past year, which is a fairly frequent, we have about four northbounds and four southbound vessels calling through Juneau and on up into the northern corridor here every week. And so I don't think that this summer, at any rate, that we're going to see any appreciable change. Because of budget limitations, the governor has proposed a budget that is about $10 million less for the ferry system than it had last year. And that will substantially reduce the frequency next winter. And the decision point as to exactly what that's going to consist of has to take place around the 1st of May. Schedules are always anywhere from 6 months to 8 months ahead of time, and you really begin to sell a lot of your space well on up ahead. So in May, they'll actually set up the winter schedule, and then by January, they'll actually be selling the next summer. So there's a lot of questions in everybody's mind as to just exactly what's going to take place. The new director and the new commissioner are committed to looking at all options, including some significant changes in how the vessels are operated. We've historically operated a system that is a through system. You get on in Seattle, or you get on in Prince Rupert, and you get off in Skagway. It's all the way through, and it seldom stops for any appreciable period of time in between. I think that there's a serious thought now as to coming up with a series of roads, in essence, a road from Seattle to Ketchikan, a road from Ketchikan to Juneau. The vessels now providing these roads. A road from Juneau to Skagway via Haines. All in cases the road would be a vessel. The road to Seattle to Ketchikan might be the Columbia, and the other one might be the Malaspina and Matanuska, all the way from Ketchikan to Juneau. And then the only way it would match, and we discussed that this morning, would be to establish the Taku, for example, which would be a much larger vessel on a more frequent basis. It's only 5 hours from Juneau to Haines, and another hour on up to Skagway. So it's premature to know just exactly what the new administration is going to come up with in the final schedule. But I can tell you that I don't think there'll be any diminishment of the service that you see up to the north. And it could be that if they, particularly if they adopt and the models work out well, to establish these sort of linkages like I'm just relating to you, that you could actually have a more frequent vessel, say, departing out of Haines and Skagway, coming into Juneau, with maybe some minor overlay into Juneau, and then a vessel running on down to Ketchikan with maybe a fairly close connection there, and then running either to Prince Rupert or on down to Seattle. So, and the other thing that we talked about was this morning was trying to analyze if a joint agreement with BC Ferries, British Columbia Ferries, using the Queen of Prince Rupert and the Columbia on a this kind of a schedule, providing a greater frequency, particularly in the summertime, that could really generate an awful lot more tourists all the way through up through the corridor, all the way to Haines and Skagway. And personally, I see nothing but a whole lot of positiveness in the whole thing. The vessels are all in good shape. There doesn't appear to be any significant material problems. They're all in good running order now. The generators are all squared away, and the pipes are not totally rusted out yet, so I think we've got a pretty good system. Are there any questions, sir?
I just have a suggestion when you're looking at your new ferry system. A problem that I've run into, and I've come to Juneau several times, especially in the winter months, is that I work 5 days a week, and when I want to come to Juneau, I have to leave on a Friday night and get back on a Sunday. A lot of times your schedules don't permit that. I have to be there Thursday night, and I can't get back till a Tuesday or a Wednesday. I would think that with 18,000 people in Whitehorse and 25,000 people in Juneau, that we could be looking at a mini tourism type exchange where people from Juneau would go over to Whitehorse for weekend shopping or visiting, and vice versa. And then when they're drawing up this new schedule, we could look at possibly. I don't know how much you'd have to make changes, but if they arrived in Skagway at 4 o'clock on Friday instead of leaving at 5, they would leave at 7:30 or 8. They would stay there an extra 2 hours to pick up the people who might come down, and then both tourism branches could promote this type of exchange. And I think it would be a first step in I guess tourism initially, and hopefully down the road when we have a free trade agreement, that we could work the other way too.
One of the objectives that Juneau has had for a long period of time is to set itself up as a trade center for southeastern Alaska, and so that would fit in really really well, I think, with that objective that the southeastern has established. I would strongly suggest that you you document any ideas that you have along those lines. Maybe even set up a little time to meet with the director and commissioner and pass those informations on to him, because they're interested.
Time we have a free trade agreement, of course, we'll beam people back and forth.
Could I ask if there's any linkage between the question we were talking about, the movement of goods and access there, and the question that Piers raised about choke points such as the terminal Skagway, and the one bill I saw here, which is, what is it, the is that the one to create the Marine Authority?
Yes, HB 62.
Which seems to talk about some fairly broad powers. Is it Is it contemplated by yourself that those powers might be exercised in respect to not only the movement of people, but by goods through ports such as Skagway, the one we know best, of course?
Yes, very readily could. I introduced HB 62. It's my feeling that Department of Transportation is cumbersome, and that it has so heavy a load that the Marine Highway should be separated from the Department of Transportation, set into an authority of its own. Then very definitely they would have those powers in that bill. Do you agree, Bill?
Yeah. The system should, and it always has, take into consideration more than just passengers and vehicles. It ought to take into, you know, the freight movement as well, and the competitive private lines that operate in the areas too. Again, this is an area that really should be getting with the system, and the ferry system, and explaining what you think, you know, might be improved.
But you raised the question of competition earlier, as you did in respect to the last meeting, and the White House. Of course, the real problem for us in terms of competition, but also price, is the what Piers talked about at the choke point, is that we have one company essentially controlling the terminals. That's heavy. And I'm curious about your notions as to the resolution of that problem.
I think I've.
Because it's historic in our case, of course.
You're not talking about the. The ore loading facility. You're talking about the whole port, the whole
that. I mean, that's the key one. I believe it's not entirely facetious to say that the company that's using that facility now is probably paying in the annual rent what you could have bought it for a couple of years ago.
I haven't checked into that. That's interesting.
Yeah, I don't believe that it was envisioned that the Marine Highway Authority would get involved in anything other than roll-on, roll-off freight and goods that would normally come over the ferry.
The reason I'm asking is if you have all the competition of the water you want, but if you get to the port,
then how would it be him?
It's an interesting question. I haven't examined it in that perspective.
I haven't either, but I certainly will.
Well, let me just raise it. I wonder if we have a community of interest in that.
Have you got a proposal in that respect? What would you like to see?
I think you probably have a proposal once the sort of the pre-feasibility study is done, because it will discuss ultimately the projected flow of goods through the port, and what we expect would come through the port, the load factor, and whether or not the existing port facility could be expanded, or whether it would be advisable to introduce more players in Skagway. I understand that Skagway has done a number of feasibility studies themselves. Nothing as all-encompassing as what we're proposing here, or what we're initiating here. But I think once we have the results of that study, I think it would become a lot more clear to us exactly what's possible.
Federal highway dollars, of course, that will be used for port development, roads and connecting roads, and so there's a potential if we could qualify it, and if we could identify, you know, what the potential expansion and what the economics of that would mean, not only to you but also to the, you know, to Alaska and particularly Skagway. I think that it would be worth looking into. Probably your feasibility study that you've got going will be good information for us.
If I could just mention, you raised earlier on the possibilities of improving the transportation links between Juneau and Whitehorse, or something, what that might do for the trade and commerce between the two areas. And people similarly have raised that question about the Alaska Highway West of Yukon, what it does for communications and that. I think one could observe the amount of traffic now between Skagway and Whitehorse in the wintertime as a result of opening that road. It's really quite remarkable. You see that, I mean, people in Whitehorse shopping or just coming for an excursion to the Whitehorse, or, you know, movie and show. And a lot of people doing leisurely drives into Skagway in the winter and just for, I think it's probably been good for both communities. And I think the possibilities on those other axes are
I have a little problem sometimes. in separating, I mean, we talk about trade and commerce, and then we put tourism over here, and to me they should all be in the same pot. Has the Canadian government, and I'm sure you have, done studies on the amount of tourism that's coming through Skagway? Has it increased since the... We couldn't have a study on whether it's increased since the road's been open year-round, because that just happened.
Well, they did a study, essentially, which didn't concentrate on tourism or sort of general freight haul or anything else. They did sort of an all-encompassing study, which took into account Beaufort explorations and oil development in the Beaufort Sea, and determined that for certain kinds of freight that wouldn't be carried around Bering Sea and into the Beaufort, but would be brought up through either the Mackenzie or Mackenzie Delta area or through Skagway. Certain kinds of freight would be hauled through the Skagway route, and anticipated that the Skagway-Inuvik corridor would be the corridor of consequence in a decade or two. And that was one of the reasons that was one of the justifications that we got initially to get the $20 million plus to provide in federal funding to upgrade the Skagway Carcross Road.
Well, have you, are there any definite figures on tourism as far as the Marine Highway is concerned? The number of people it brings in or anything like that during the summer?
Yeah, I'm not too familiar with those figures. Perhaps I can't remember. I do know that they're...
I think they're all homogenized together, appears that yeah. They kind of differentiate the local traffic going back and forth
yeah.
from the tourist traffic.
I see.
Did you project increases?
You can identify the people getting off the cruise ships, but that's...
Yeah.
I think, Betty, maybe your ferry system would have more accurate figures in the last year or two since the Skagway Road's open of the amount of traffic that was getting off at Skagway versus Haines. And before, I think a lot of them used to go on to Haines, and we're finding now a great many.
That's what I was curious about, if they're going on, instead of taking the Haines cutoff, if they were going on in through Whitehorse, and therefore allowing those tourists possibly to stop, purchase, and this sort of thing.
And what we're trying to determine right now, too, is how much traffic we're redirecting from the Alaska Highway coming up from British Columbia, and that which would have come through Haines, how much we're redirecting through Skagway. We've got to be fairly careful that we don't just assume that the increase in traffic on Skagway Road is a net increase to Yukon or to the general area. We have to consider that perhaps there's a corresponding decrease through other transportation corridors, and we suspect there might be at this point.
We should be interested in our getting some of those figures, too.
We appreciate it, yeah. Very much.
Okay, we'll try to, from our ferry system, try to get some of those figures.
Yes. I have a question. On the study that you're talking about, when is this going to be finalized?
Well, I would suspect probably by early summer that we'll have what we need.
In that case, then, once you finalize it, just forward one to Betty, one to the commissioner. Later on, you know, obviously we're going to be out of session, but review that next session.
Yeah, but we do have an interim committee that works during the interim.
So just send her a copy and Rocky a copy. And just take it there.
Sure, I can.
Yes?
I'm trying. There is a regional marketing effort that is taking place right now, and I believe at least the city of Whitehorse is participating in that. Juneau and all of the southeastern communities have formed up a kind of a regional marketing. I think it's more than tourism, but maybe it's tourism. And we should find out who, in particularly on the cities, involved into that, because I think your Visitors and Convention Bureau or something like that is involved in it.
I think it's through the Chambers.
That's where it's at, through the Chambers. They're already accumulating some information, which I don't think they've got enough of it yet, but there ought to be some real good information from that effort.
I think another thing the committee ought to know, too, and I'm not sure that you still do have, but at one time you did have, or you did appropriate a substantial amount of money to tourism.
And we still do. We, in fact, do considerable joint marketing with the state of Alaska, tourism stuff.
And that's why I say I have a problem in taking market goods and tourism and separating them, because they kind of all mesh in the same basket.
The danger of us not discriminating on that score, in terms of that we have some problem of self-delusion with the numbers. If we don't, we were making calculations on the impact on our economy of tourism, of visitors, while simultaneously calculating that there would be, it was a continuing on a 10-year time frame, declining per capita expenditure in tourism, by tourists. Well, by everything else we knew from elsewhere, that was nonsense. And we've done a closer look recently that really makes it look like, in all probability, the tourism stats are inflated because of us counting internal travelers. I mean, people travel
that's
in
right,
the
local travel. Right. I think there's
really
some
merit. You really aren't tourists.
Yes, Madam Chairman, I think there's some merit in cross-referencing the figures. It would be interesting to see what statistics Alaska has for border crossings and traffic. And it wouldn't surprise me one bit to find out that your figures are much different than ours. And that inflated factor may show up in our figures because of the local traffic movement.
Well, that was one reason I was thinking about it.
Mm-hmm. Then it decides on which side of the argument you are, which figures you want to use.
Yeah.
Two sets of figures for two
right. Different.
At least you have more to look at that way.
Madam Chairman, I'd like to get back a little bit further discussion on the question of the port and primarily the Skagway and the Alaska Marine Line. Now, you've passed that resolution. Is the state of Alaska going to be taking any further steps in respect to that application?
Well, the resolution is merely passed the House. It's in the Senate now.
Is there any other steps that the administration could be taking in respect to that?
I think there could be dialogue taking place between the governor and Ottawa or that sort of thing.
I noticed when the resolution passed the House that you had Frank from Kerr Resources and Mr. Troy from Alaska Marine Lines, and there was nobody from White Pass. Were they asked to appear? Or?
I asked that very question.
Yeah, they didn't
We have to go. I asked the very question on the Florida House, because I kind of thought it should have gone to Ottawa to respect the minister, but this has to go through the State Department. And then the State Department talks to Ottawa. And we do the full circle. We're talking among ourselves here, but we still have to go through your respective channels, our respective channels. But I asked that very question, that the State Department prefers to handle it this way. That's where we are.
Well, there is some concern on their behalf regarding the haulage of goods, American goods versus Canadian goods and so on. And it's a concern that could have been expressed at the...
The one element that I felt that had put some favor with Alaska Marine Lines, that they did come in and provide a service when they were right in the height of the recession, and provided a pretty reasonable cost. And then all of a sudden things got a little better, then we said no, you know, and I really questioned that.
Yes, they've also put some good solid dollars in improving the road as well.
Mm-hmm.
That, better than a million. Something like that. They've upgraded that road link each year. They bought some new equipment and things like that. I think we're only interested in fair play. There are Canadian vessels operating under the waiver of the Jones Act, which is the U.S. Shipping Act, from Vancouver to Whittier, and we've had rail traffic there providing an awful lot of the goods going to the slope. And this is an American company that's operating under good faith, equipped up, ready to go on this route, and from what we could gather, Dinneray was providing some discounted freight service into your communities in the Yukon. And we'd just like to have fair treatment.
Just one further question, if I could, Madam Chairman. In the testimony that was given by Alaska Marine Lines, did they give any statistical data or information that would show that they would do it for much more competitive rates than what we're presently getting?
I don't think they brought that particular matter up, if I remember right. I think they made the statement that they would meet competition. I don't think they discussed rates per se.
Mr. Chairman, I think one thing that made some of us rather nervous, I guess, when we were being lobbied around the time the Canadian Passport Commission was making its decision, was that White Pass had indicated that they would match whatever price competition was providing, no matter what the price was. It always leaves one wondering whether or not the price that they offer at any time is the best price possible. So the simply the promise that they'll be competitive doesn't always make one feel comfortable. Doesn't make me feel comfortable ever. And I think for that reason, the true competitive environment where the marine vessels are actually providing a service is the only one where we can really test the lowest price, best service, highest frequency of service.
Yeah, they're both running.
Yeah.
I see what you mean. You can't very well go on a promise on either one of them if they're going to have a monopoly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because they're going to set whatever they deem fit to do, and if it's a monopoly, you're going to have to swallow it. We're all going to have to swallow it. You know what I mean? And I go along your line of thinking there. Well, if I have asked Henry, who has spent 23 years in the field with DOT, to share some ideas with you. He's an engineer, has worked both in the administration, but primarily in the field administration rather than bureaucratic administration, and is a very good addition. He's newly elected from the city of Nome, and has been working with DOT up there many years. Henry, would you like to share some of your thoughts with him?
Sure. It took us 23 years to get everything screwed up to the point where I had to get the hell out of there. It was easy. Well, I know the problems are similar. I have been primarily in design and construction, but in the last 14 years in operation and maintenance. And we got quite often together with your operational counterparts in the UCOM because of the similarity of the problems. And I think it'd be just redundant to go through all the type of stuff, but there are some fairly unique problems which I personally would be interested how they are being handled in the UConn, and they have magnified themselves out because of the budgetary crisis that has developed again, where we get that finger-pointing process. Everybody tries to push the problem off on the next party, and then it goes full circle, comes around again. Right now, I think we've got two big problems. One of them is to push things from their state responsibility to a local level. And I would be interested, for example, do you have suburban roads and things like that handled in a collective manner by municipalities, or do you have a similar jurisdictional mishmash like we have? Some state routes that go through a municipality, for example, are being handled by the state, and then all the other roads around it by a municipality, and there's certainly a lot to be said for, you know, having it either or in form of reciprocal agreement or having just one transportation group jurisdiction for all situations.
We have mishmash. We do have federal highways running through municipalities. All highways are maintained by the Yukon government. But on the capital side, there are the Department of Public Works owns some highways. Another federal department owns other highways. The Yukon government owns and operates or maintains some highways inside municipalities. So essentially, we have a number of jurisdictions. It hasn't proven to be much of a problem in my experience to administer it. Because it's the distinction is fairly clean. It's primarily the numbered highways for which the Yukon government has responsibility for, and it is all other roads in the municipality primarily the responsibility of the municipality.
You don't feel that, considering the expense of the type of equipment that is involved, the support facilities, and all that type of things, that it is a certain amount of duplication involved in that and correspondingly a high expense for it?
I think on the capital side, I think you're right. And I think devolution of the roads program from the federal government to the Yukon government will clarify that jurisdictional responsibilities. The Yukon government is the only road maintainer of the senior levels of government. and municipalities are the primary maintainers of their own roads. It hasn't been perceived to be too much of a problem with respect to the relative roles between the municipality and senior partners, but there are some savings that can be affected through some clarifying of the roles between Yukon government and the federal government. And what we're ultimately going to propose, I'm sure, would be
Department of Public Works and the old Highways Department and maybe the Department of Transportation Public Facilities. It's just about 10 years ago now. And that has been, I would say, a mixed success. What worked well was to put the aviation facilities and the service and marine transportation facilities together. I think that is good because they're, even though they're different modes of transportation, they had definitely the same problems from all standpoints, engineering, design, construction, administration, and so on. And in the outlying areas where, of course, the aviation aspect is more pronounced, and we've got about 280 airports, that has worked out well, and we hardly do any work out there now anymore. We contract everything with the municipalities and with the villages on a local level basis in form of a bid process. We advertise for bids every year for maintenance, and primarily maintenance and upkeep of aviation facilities and roads if they are isolated. And that has proven to be very cost effective from the standpoint how much it costs. Yeah. But there are still problems like the question of liability. I think we have been very fortunate that no major disasters have occurred that brought that to light. Our risk management people are not very delighted with that whole setup. But nevertheless, it's been working now for about 6 years that way. And then when you're talking about the cost savings and figuring, for example, what is your risk factor then in the relationship to money, I think it's turned out to be fine. I support that concept a lot. I also would support that concept what we're doing right now to give more of, say, of especially in discontinued situations where we have local roads and stuff like that to the municipalities, either on a prorated basis or on a bid type basis. The other thing I'm really wondering about is I'm sure you have the same thing. We have a multitude of small historic roads, we call them mining roads and stuff like that. We're category 3 right now, that is, as it is aptly described, anything except category 1 and 2. And I'm sure Yukon, British Columbia, and so on has the same type of problem. And there are more problems with those type of roads than with the primary systems or the secondary systems because they're so hard to define, they don't have any standards. We have horrible cases of liability exposure because of the ununiformity, the unsafe portions of them, and so on. Our new proposal with our budget crunch is basically to look at them like they ain't there. That's the approach to it. And on top of it, we are going to close more highways in the winter, don't maintain them in the winter, and that has in return brought up a pretty big problem with people that live along those highways not having access, and bigger portions of his children don't have access to school busing. Have you got a similar problem, and if so, how are you handling that?
Just keep them all open.
Yeah. We've closed a few, but it's a very tough decision to make for exactly the reasons you're talking about. We have what we're doing right now through a local plaster miners association. We're essentially inventorying all the roads. We have hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands and thousands of mining roads, we call tote roads, cat trails, everything from a cat trail to something that's been engineered by somebody or other. And there's always demands upon the Department of Transportation to maintain a road. There's only a limited extent to which you can do that, of course. So we're going to have to wrestle with it. We have been wrestling with the liability question. We'll be developing a new revamped Highways Act, I would think, in the next couple of years, which will address in part the liability question, I guess, whether or not we simply disown the existence of certain roads rather than try to claim them in some way or recognize them in some formal way. But many of those problems are our problems as well. We haven't, one of the things you did bring up was the question of contracting out of services. Haven't received any serious proposals for the contracting out of highway services, perhaps with the exception of Norma Cassie, my colleague's community, home community, which is essentially a community that's in part maintained by the highways camp. There are really no highways to speak of to maintain. They act as sort of surrogate government for a variety of things. But the maintenance section of our highways branch has a fairly good reputation, and has a very good reputation up against contractors who are doing maintenance operations in British Columbia. So I think people, on the whole, are fairly respectful of the efficiencies and the ability of our highway maintenance section to do the job. So we haven't really, there's been no groundswell of opinion that suggests we should investigate other alternatives.
Yeah, we had the same situation. Nobody was very enthused about private contracting. Interesting enough, in the isolated areas, 78% or something like that of all the bidders are municipalities now. The local people don't, and there are reasons for that. One of them is the inability for the state to give more than a one-year contract because the monies are appropriated by the legislature every year. So there can be no assurance that you're going to have a contract more than 1 year. And then, in turn, a private individual can't get the financing or from a bank for a piece of equipment for any longer. So that's one reason why municipalities are more successful. But on the other hand, we have cases, too, where especially miners do have equipment of their own that is financed through their operation. And invariably, they come in higher than city government again. So we've been actually quite happy. We do not let the thing just go. The government is still overseeing that the contract stipulations are met, and therefore the standards of maintenance and operation are met. And one thing we found, especially in airports, was that local residents just responded timelier and better because they had their own welfare at stake. You know, if you sit in Nome or in Fairbanks and you do everything from remote, you say, yeah, but how is that? I mean, they can wait another couple of days before airplane gets in. No sweat off our back. But if you live there, then you get the old engine fired up and you clear the runway. And so from that standpoint, and if there's a complaint that says, well, run down and see your own, buddy, don't bellyache at me. Go get your own people to do it. So I think that has worked very well. And how do you maintain and operate facilities? The building portion of the, what's the state of? Is that a separate outfit from transportation? Or?
No, it's incorporated into the transportation department's operations. They own and operate all the significant buildings apart from the administrative section, which is maintained by our equivalent to public facilities, Department of Government Services.
Yeah, that's what we're doing too. And I don't think our show is very successful because usually the buildings people take a rear seat to the rolling stock people. You know, there's no glory in painting a building. So that's definitely more glamorous. But I'd be glad to answer any question you may have. Like I said, I'm an old field hand. I've been out in the weeds over the last 23 years, and the only suggestion I have always is to do away with headquarters.
Universal suggestion.
We also have another expert on our, we have two other experts. Drew lives in our largest municipality. And, of course, their road problems are a great deal different than a lot of our bush problems. Drew, would you like to make some comments?
Well, very briefly, I do live in Anchorage. I represent West Anchorage, which is the part of the city that our international airport is in. I've been to Anchorage. One of the things we're seeing is that we have a lot of state roads within the municipality, but this year DOT is telling us that because of budget cuts, the city is going to be responsible for maintaining those roads, both for plowing the snow, for the actual maintenance, so on and so forth. The city, of course, says it doesn't have the money, and right now is already at the tax cap, so they don't feel they can raise property taxes to pay for that. And we're in a situation where we won't finish our budget until sometime in May. The city sets its mill rate in April, so even if we come in and say that they're going to have to pick up the difference, they would not be able to do it until next year, and we'd have a winter where there wasn't any snow plow. So we've got one of the situations that is kind of a catch-22. We're cutting our municipal revenue sharing and municipal assistance to the cities throughout the state, be they urban or rural, and it's a real tough planning problem for our municipalities in particular, because they don't know what, and it's not just for transportation, it's for education and everything else. They don't know from year to year what they're going to get from us. And because we've had so much money, we've been able to give them a lot of money, and they've come to depend on it, as is always the case. I'm sure you see the same thing. So now the weaning process back away from that revenue sharing and union assistance is very painful all the way around. And our mayor has been calling a group of us in the from Anchorage just this morning to talk about, geez, what in the world is going on down there? And lobbyists have been running around trying to figure out where they're going to be, because they just don't know. It's very difficult. Makes it real hard to plan. Now, I have a specific question, if I could. I'm curious. I'm working on a bill that hasn't been introduced yet, because we are trying to do better than we did with our railroad transfer. I'm working on a bill that would transfer our two international airports into an airport authority and take them out from under Department of Transportation and Public Facilities, because one's in Anchorage and one's in Fairbanks, and right now, although the monies go into the same pot, management was out of two different regional directors in DOT, and so there was no co-management. The one end didn't talk to the other at all. And is the airport in Whitehorse a federal airport, or is it run by the
federal airport?
It is federal. And how many then? How many territorial, or how many are there that belong to? Are most of your airports federal, or most of them local community, or what level are they at?
Well, right now, ultimately, all the airports apart from emergency airstrips are federal. What we're going to have transferred to us are all but the airports at Watson Lake and Whitehorse. And the federal government right now, for example, is going through an exercise at decentralizing its own airport operations. And what they would like to do, we have discussed this in government circles at all, I'm not sure how much people know about it, but what the federal government would like to do is to turn over airports to community authorities. They don't want to privatize them as such, to a private operator. But apart from the major ones of Vancouver, Edmonton, Ottawa, Toronto, Montreal, they would like to have essentially a community authority operate. And it would be a division of a community government. It wouldn't be a provincial government. It would be a community government of one sort or another.
What's been happening in the last few years is they have been cutting back and reducing the services and the staffing, and not only in airports, but in ancillary services, weather forecasting, air traffic controllers. This is all part of the attack on the federal deficit. It means that when we come to negotiate transfers and some of these things, in fact, we're negotiating a transfer with a much smaller base than was previously the case, would have been the case 5 years ago or 6 years ago. In some senses, I mean, it appears more responsible, but in some senses, it may give us some less attractive propositions than we might have had we been into these discussions only a few years ago.
We don't really get the feds aren't so much trying to give those ancillary services to us, but what they are doing is sitting on it's at least $8 billion that's sitting in the FAA fund, because that helps make our deficit look less. So there's all this money sitting there that is not being spent on upgrading all of the radar systems and so on and so forth. So there's an outcry throughout the country that they've got to let that money loose. In Alaska, we'll see a portion of it, but certainly not a huge portion.
What the federal government, too, is trying to do is to enhance the user pay concept on all airport operations. And that wouldn't simply mean an increase to the landing taxes or anything of that sort. But it would primarily, I guess, mean the creation of businesses in airport operations. so that the rent from businesses, it could be everything from hotels to shops to works. And usually airport businesses have a bit of a leg up in certain communities because there's so much traffic that's funneled through that one operation. And it's so convenient, especially hotel operations, etc. It's so convenient that it's a very lucrative business.
Except when you get a new airport like we have in Whitehorse, which has surplus capacity, so for a while, the merchandising space, I mean, it's probably not going to be that way.
Yeah, we are concerned in the Whitehorse situation about the move to user pay because it's such a low volume airport in comparison to some of its larger counterparts.
It's overbuilt right now.
And there are only a few airports in the country, as a matter of fact, who people project could pay for themselves under existing conditions.
Dee, did you?
I just wanted to make some comments about the concern of weaning the public or the electorate from the services, and I think that, you know, when you come to times when you have budget tight crunches and you're looking at removing services, I think in the long run you can reorganize and you can decentralize and you can realign and you can do all of these things which just put off the ultimate decision that you have to make. And I guess it all depends whether you're going to be there in office or whether you're not because of the timing of the decision. But I think in the long run, it's far better for the people that the decision be made and that the weaning process start before you fool the people with all the reorganization and decentralization and just get at it. And
I agree.
I might make a comment that on this, one of my communities, and to me, it's been a tragedy. At the time of the municipal assistance and revenue sharing came in, that city had an 11 mil tax rate. When it came in, they dropped their millage to 1 mil. And now they're going to be in one hell of a bundle of herd.
But, you know, again,
yes.
You know what the deal was on the state's coming in and this, hey, well, here's municipal assistance for revenue sharing,
right.
And we're taking a piece of the wealth and lower your property tax but still maintain the services.
And now that we can no longer do that, mm-hmm. they're going to be, as I said, in a world of hurt. Bill?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. A question, kind of a follow-up to something that Henry brought up. He indicated that most of the works are going out to municipalities because they're the only ones that can really carry something for more than a year or go out and develop the equipment. Does your government offer bids or bid on multi-year contracts, for example, the whole project? Have you found that to be efficient?
Yeah, there's very depends on the contract, but there is the ability to go into long-term contracts. It's just like, for example, in our busing contract, it doesn't make sense to go on annual busing contract.
How about construction, though, capital improvement, things
still,
like that?
Still depends on the annual appropriation.
Well, yeah, it depends on the annual appropriation, but the government does have the ability to go.
We have some limitations in doing that. The tradition has not been to go for very long-term contracts, although we are finding some imperative to look at two situations. I don't know what it's like in the state of Alaska, but we have access to capital, venture capital, finance capital. Practically non-existent in our community. We have our banks that we have, our national Canadian charter banks, which are among the most conservative financial institutions in the world. That's why they're so big and so wealthy, but they're not very imaginative when it comes to financing even real estate propositions. In Canada, they tend to be financed through trust companies and insurance companies and other kinds of financing mechanisms. But we have no trust companies. We have no domestic insurance companies. So when a developer comes along and wants to put up a major building, or office building, they have to go look for AAA tenants. Well, the only AAA tenants around are banks and the government in our community. That's literally the case. So they come to us and they want, for financial purposes, that we've recently been approached to sign or enter into 10-year leases. But we've never entered into a 10-year lease in our lives. And so it's an entirely novel proposition for us. But for them, for developers, student conflict, there's no way they can even imagine putting up any kind of a sizable facility or substantial facility without that. And that's a whole mix of problems that we have in that school. The other reason that we've added is we found that some cases, I think you were talking about some of the contracting people, exactly that problem you addressed. Local entrepreneurs may want to get into a certain kind of business which will provide what we regard as a very useful service for a community, something we don't want to be involved in. But since we are creating, if you like, the cornerstone demand, they will want some kind of commitment for us for something longer than 1 year in order to get established. That's not for us to provide loans or any kind of other assistance. We will just have to make some kind of purchase or long-term purchase agreement.
Like housing?
Housing is one, but also, you know, this glue laminated beam plant, which we think is a viable economic opportunity. Without us providing any financing, what we'll have to do is we'll have to give some kind of pre-purchase commitment for something like maybe 5 years. Let's use an example. Otherwise, no business person is going to commit themselves to that. So we are having to do it.
So it seems like we're not so far apart in problems, right?
I don't think any governments are, Madam Chairman.
We just have an imaginary line up there.
Madam Chair, I just have a question that might be rather controversial, but I'm just concerned. You have a permanent fund in Alaska.
Yes.
And I understand a permanent fund is for rainy days, and I'm wondering why there's so many problems and everybody's so afraid to dip into your permanent fund.
Because you can't decide when it's raining.
It's still winter.
In Juneau, we think it's raining all the time.
Well, we have a permanent fund, which the corpus cannot be constitutionally touched. However, there's the earnings from that fund. That was what you were hearing about this morning. The earnings of the permanent fund, undistributed permanent fund earnings. See, somebody correct me if I'm... 25% goes into dividends. Am I correct? 50% goes into dividends. 25% into the undistributed permanent fund, and 25% for shoring it up, inflation?
Yeah. You got it.
Inflation proofing. And this is the earnings from, how much is the permanent fund right at the present time?
$8 million.
$8 million.
Yes, yeah, last week.
I think it's 25% of our oil revenues every year go into it, automatically.
Just automatically go into that permanent
fund. Go into the corpus that cannot be touched.
And then any new fields discovered after January 1st, 1981, it's 50%.
50%.
We wish there'd be one.
Right.
I think you're
talking about the PFD's permanent fund dividends, are you not?
Well,
I just understand
they had something like the Alberta government has, where they have a permanent fund where they did the same thing. They set up a fund for supposedly rainy days, and then the politicians get so afraid of touching it, and you convince the public that this is the bank account, this is for the days when it's really bad, that you get so afraid to touch it when you do get in there that it gets up to $8 billion, $10 billion, $20 billion, and you still have an awful lot of people unemployed, and you have all kinds of problems in the economy.
Alberta's got $30 billion in there, so the trouble is it's all invested in long-term securities, now they can't get it out.
Yeah. Because they dipped into it.
I was just wondering, there must be mixed feelings of people who do want to get at it and use some of it now and some who...
Drew.
One of the things
Drew's
that,
been a banking chief.
One of the things that happened that was a masterful stroke by former Governor Hammond, when they conceived of the permanent fund and decided to actually do it, along with it, they conceived of the permanent fund dividends, and in a way gave every person in Alaska a share of the permanent fund and made them feel like they have part of ownership of the permanent fund, which in fact they do, because that the Constitution says that these monies. The interest from these funds will be used for the future costs of state government. The problem is, people are used to us using the interest for their own permanent fund dividend. And it does add a big economic boost every year when you send $1,000 or $560 or whatever amount it happens to be that year. There's no doubt that that's a big boost, but it isn't helping to pay the operating costs of government. And what we as a group appear to be afraid to do is to cut into the amount that's given out in dividends, because this thing has taken on such a life of its own, and the dividends have too. And most people out there, if you ask the people in the state whether or not their dividend is constitutionally guaranteed, they believe it is. And it's because the sales job done by former Governor Hammond and former Governor Sheffield and a host of, and Mr. Malone, who's now our Commissioner of Revenue, has been excellent, and they have convinced the people that you've got to save the permanent fund from those people in Juneau who are going to spend it, and they've done a beautiful job of it. And I go home, and we get letters saying, don't touch the permanent fund, don't touch my dividend, and it's become one and the same. And it is, in 1983, or in 1982, during the campaigns, including the governor, former Governor Sheffield, plus at least half the legislature, campaigned on getting rid of the dividends. And they came down here, and they had not been here 60 days before you couldn't have found more than 5 votes out of 60. Mm-hmm. You honestly couldn't. It's because there were letters and so on and so forth. But isn't that right, Randy? Remember?
I'm losing that battle in my own district.
But all those people campaigning on, we're going to get rid of the dividends, silly thing to do, our income's going down, came down here and started getting the letters, and there wasn't, you know, there wasn't a single person, and I wasn't elected that year, but I was working as legislative staff, and I was amazed at how quickly people changed their minds.
At what rate do you tax that income?
We don't.
Not as a state.
We don't have a state income.
We don't have
a state income. We don't have a state income tax.
The federal government taxes it.
Feds get it.
We talked about Trudeau.
Gee, that's incredible. That's incredible, though, if you let the federal government tax that.
Oh, yeah. Right. Yeah,
or 20%.
So you, but you'll have state tax after this session, I guess.
I don't think so. Madam Chairman, if I may, I
think that, you know, the predicament that you find yourselves in, I'd be very hesitant to touch the fund because I believe in that rainy day concept, and I think that the general public would agree with that. I don't think you'd find a lot of people in the general public that would disagree with the concept or the attitude that we have too much government. Government is overpaid. We have a bloated bureaucracy. All these little things. Mr. Chairman, I'm sure, Madam Chairman, I'm sure that the public would respond quite favorably to the withdrawal of some services and prioritizing of some services, and then they may be in a position to negotiate with their legislators as to whether they're prepared to give up their fund or accept a state tax or whatever. I mean, there are certain ways to sell things instead of just.
Be highly inappropriate, of course, for us to come over and precipitate some kind of ideological debate here.
No.
Ask Bill Hudson, because he's from Juneau. He's got a different...
But the same public that are complaining about the bloody bureaucracy and the new government are also continually demanding new services.
Oh, yeah.
And they'll scream like hell the minute you talk about cutting one of them.
Right.
But, you know, politicians continue to give the services and...
We're not going to be able to afford to continue giving them.
Well, two things. I've got to go to, speaking of permanent fund, the issue is going to be up in 5 minutes, and you ought to come and listen to it. Former Governor Hammond will be before State Affairs, so that will be his key. There's two things that I want to. I traveled quite a bit in 70, 74, back and forth. Made a number of speeches in both Whitehorse and Calgary and Edmonton, and this is when we were really working together, and the common goal at that particular time was the development of the resources of our respective areas. And we were supportive of each other at that particular time. It appears, however, and I saw a little cartoon in your White Horse paper, that on ANWA we are, for whatever reason, on a collision course. And I would like myself personally to get as much information as I can regard your concerns for ANWR. The commonality appears that we've got the caribou herd moving back and forth, and I know that's a long question. Then secondly, I notice under education here, we are coming to grips with our telecommunication problem in Alaska. We have we utilize satellites and dishes, etc., and it's been kind of one of these things that has grown like Topsy, but I know Canada has been a leader in video text and other types of things in your education. I would appreciate your forwarding to me anything you can on what you're doing in telecommunications, and by telecommunications I mean digital, voice, telephone, audio, and particularly in areas of government efficiency, because you must have the same problem that we do, and in your area of education. I realize those are rather large subjects, but I'm up in 421, and I would be glad to share with you the conclusions that our committee has reached at this particular point. And I'm Representative H.A. Red, and originally coming out of Quebec, Boucher, to you. I wonder what B-O-U-C-H-E-R is about you, but it's... And I'm in room 421, and we would be glad to give you several reports that we've done that take an overview of telecommunication in Alaska, and maybe something in this area that we can learn from each other.
We'll see to it, too, that you get a copy of the legislators' addresses, and committees. We'll try to send the committees that they're on. Perhaps you'll be interested in contacting them as individuals, along with our commissions and that sort of thing. And we'll also furnish, by the way, Red is also a former lieutenant governor of the state of
Alaska. That's when I was traveling over there, making, who was this very popular,
Bell?
Doug Bell?
No, out of, at this time it was Edmonton and Calgary, out of Alberta.
Lottie?
Yeah, right. I remember taking the table in a combined effort of the development of North America's resources, and you folks were being slowed down by the East, much the same as we were. So,
yeah, still are.
So I hate to see us bumping against each other on this, and I'm sure you have some good reasons, and since we will be talking about it, I'd like to see it from the Canadian viewpoint.
I understand that's a substantial question when we meet with the Resources Committee. Norma Cassie, as we know, represents the Canadian Oak Crow.
Good. Used to be a father, Oak Crow, father...
Boucher.
Huh?
Dan Boucher.
Yeah.
Oh, wonderful.
Early 60s,
man.
Huh?
Still
alive.
Still teaching skiing. He's got
What a fact. He's 69. He brought cross-country skiing to Fairbanks and from there to Alaska. At that time, you bought a pair of cross-country skis. Everybody thought you were nuts. What are you doing with cross-country skis?
Yeah. And
give me my best
thing.
Wonderful man.
Well, I do appreciate you all being here. I know you have something on your schedule for 3 o'clock. Representative Springer has a committee meeting that he has to chair, of which I'm vice chair of. You're going to be here until what time?
Well, they have it scheduled at 3:30, and I meet with the commissioner here.
No, but I mean, what day?
Wednesday at 3:30. Wednesday in the afternoon will be here.
Great, so we'll see a lot more of you. We'll particularly see you tonight at dinner.
Mm-hmm. Yes, ma'am.
My apologies for running. I got to go over and listen to the permanent.
You know what?
Centennial Hall. It's a new building.
Meeting is adjourned at 2:59.